คมOm Sahana Bhavatu Sahana Bhunaktu Saha Viryam Karavavahai Tejasvinavati Tamastu Mavidvishavahai Om Shanti 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 Verse 11Dvandvani sarvanya kilastri putyaha Dvandvani sarvanya kilastri putyaha Kinshit samashritya dipanti vastu Kinshit samashritya dipanti vastu Tanmargane syat galitam samastam Tanmargane syat galitam samastam Napashyatam satchalanam kadapi Napashyatam satchalanam kadapi Dvandvani Sarvani Akilaha Triputyaha Kinchit Samashritya Vibhanti Vastu Tan Margane Syat Galitam Samastam Napashyatam Sat Chalanam Kadapi Dvandvani Sarvani. All of the dvandvas means all of the pairs, all of the dualities, such as in the Bhasha, he'll say, such as Atma, Anatma, self, not self. Jada, Chetana, inert, conscious. Drik, Drishya, seer, seen. Vishya, Vishayi. Vishayi, Vishya. Vishayi is the object and the substantive and the adjective, etc. All of these dualities, right? All of these opposites. Dvandvani Sarvani. Sarvani means all. So, nominative plural. Dvandvani Sarvani. And he says, and Akilaha Triputyaha, and all of the triads also. He only cites one triad here, like Nyatra Jnana Jnaya. Nyatra means the knower, the act of knowing, and the object of knowledge. So then you would say, like, the seer, the seeing, the object of sight, the hearer, the hearing, the object of the sound, right? The object of hearing. So all dvandvas, all of these opposites, all of these dualities, and all of the triads, he says, Kinchit samashrita vibhanti vastu. Those are all known. Those all appear to you. Those are all shine. It means they are in your awareness. Samashritya, depending upon kinchit vastu, something. They depend upon something else. In order for them all to shine, for all of them to be known, really, they are depending upon something else. Okay, so that's going to be the inquiry. So he says, ten margane. When that is inquired into, that thing which these opposites and all these triads depend upon, when you for their appearance, for their being known, vibhanti means for them to shine, to appear, to like, for instance, with a painting. The painting is there, but how do I know it's there? It's appearing to me. The fact that it can appear to me, that it can be known, depends upon something else, right? Or there's no way of knowing it, right? So, inquiring into that, ten margane syat, galitam samastam, all of these things, all of these triads and all of these dualities, they vanish. Galitam means vanish. They disappear completely, he says. Napashyatam satchalanam kadapi. For the one who is Pashyatam means it's a present participle. For the one who is in the genitive plural. For those who are seeing that sat, that which is existing, that which is really being, that which is really there. For those who are seeing that sat chit really, he says, for that person, na chalanam kadapi, there is no chalanam, there is no motion, there is no wavering at all. So these verses now from kind of this point on are going to be giving one prakriya after another in Ramana's style. So now here what we're looking at is that I almost did a guided meditation, which we might end up doing for a moment in the middle of the class. We're just looking now, if you're looking out at your experiences, you see all of these different pairs of opposites, you know? But if I want to inquire into the into the reality of these pairs of opposites, you know, like my knowledge, that's the next one. Like I can look at you and say you are sentient and this is an inert and the rug is inert. Or I can say I am the seer and you are the seen. I am a conscious being. These things are not conscious. All of these statements, all of these dualities that I actually experience, once I inquire into the nature of the person, of the one, because of whom these dualities and triads are known, because they appear. Appear means that they come into my consciousness. So all of these experiences, whether I say sentient, insentient, know or known, all of the dwandvas and all of the triads, all of these things are shining to me, appearing to me. And so if I inquire into that one that they depend upon for their being known, then in that inquiry, all of them disappear. Okay? That's what's being said. And that one that is left over when I'm inquiring into the one, when I'm inquiring into the one because of whom all of these are illumined or all of these are known, in that inquiry, first of all of those things disappear. And second of all, the one that is responsible for who is really the luminary, the sat chit, the conscious being, that one never changes. Chalana means change, or something to change or ripple or modify. And so, for those who recognize that one because of whom all of these shine, for that person, for that one, there is no change or modification at all. That's the nishta. So he talks about this nichalanam, this not changing, this not modifying, because throughout he's going to be talking about sitting the mind sitting in the nishta, abiding in that nishta of oneself. And that nishta is a changeless state. It's not a state, really. It's the recognition of the self, which is changeless. So the mind's seeing or abiding in that changelessness. That changeless nature of yourself never modifies in any way. It never changes in any way. And so here, you have to remember with Ramana spent his life until many years just sitting in samadhi, right? So that he kept his mind always, so that was his practice really. And in fact, until he met some pundits who just went through a few Upanishads with him. And he kind of realized exactly the reality of the whole thing. But that whole time, he spent his time in Nirvikalpa Samadhi. And so when his students came and sat before him, and he had his own teaching methodology, he wanted to make them recognize what he recognized. What he would do is take all different types, different descriptions of your experience, and always ask you to, instead of focusing on the different dualities or the triads in your experience or the things that you are objectifying in your experience, to always turn your mind toward the one because of whom these things were known. Who is the one knowing? You know. So now, if you are sitting, listening, and kind of following that teaching methodology, what happens is that your mind now, or if we do a guided meditation, your mind now, instead of focusing on the triad or the dwandvas, the dualities, is now focusing on the nature of the self because of whom these are known. The nature of the conscious being because of whom these are known. And if you start questioning in that way, the questioning is going to take the mind inward, 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 and inward in the sense that instead of objectifying something, you know, to look at something, you're going toward the nature of the one who is looking. When you go toward the nature of the one who is so-called looking, the nature of the subject, what happens is all of these objects disappear because your mind isn't focused on them. You know, it's the same, this is a very, very simple and real concept. It's the same as, you know, when we do the Driksha Viveka, the seer seeing analysis, and we use this example that, you know, in order for the sense organs to function, they require the backing of the mind. Right? The mind requires, the sense organs require the use of the mind. The mind has to use the sense organs in order to perceive an object. Because we all have the example of sitting here, for instance, listening to class, and your sense organs are here, your body is here, everything's in here from the standpoint of the viewer, the one looking at you. But even though these sense organs are here, if your mind is daydreaming, right, there is no perception. The perception, what you perceive, you know, is whatever is the focus, whatever is the focus of your mind. That's what you perceive. If the mind isn't focused out here, you don't perceive out here. If it's not using a sense organ, you don't perceive that. If you're not, you know, using your ears, you don't hear anything. If the mind isn't backing the ears. So in contemplation, what we're doing in the whole kind of Driksha seer seeing sequence is we're pulling the mind inward away from these externalizations, these objectifications. And every step of the way that you do that, what you're now experiencing is, again, whatever the mind is focused on. So if you turn your focus, the focus of the mind, away from these kind, and for ruminants, these kind of questions, what is sentient, what is inert, who is the seer, who is the seeing, all of these type of dualities, what is this, what is this, what is this, what is the truth of these triads? You turn your mind toward the one who is asking this question, the one because of whom these dwandvas and triads are known, then what is left, right? In the doing that, the dwandvas and triads fall off because there's no attention being paid to them, no focus. And what is left is just your being. And your being, the one who is lighting this whole thing up, has nothing to do with sentient or insentient. This dyad isn't there. I'm the sentiency, the sentient being, the conscious being that illumines what in the world I'm calling sentient and insentient. Or I'm illumining the sense organs and the act of perception and the object of perception. I'm the conscious being which illumines the whole thing. And this conscious being itself is not going, and I myself am not going through any type of modification. So for the people, for those who are, when this whole thing is being inquired into, and you're inquiring into what he calls the vastu. The vastu is that which is actually there, because of which all of these things are illumined. When you inquire into that, and all these things are fall away, and all that is left in your experience is your own being. And that being is not subject to any type of modification. It's not seeing, it's not hearing. So it's not that, you know, it's not seeing, it's not hearing, it's not tasting, it's not performing any act of knowership. It's also not inert. It's not subject to any type of duality. In fact, all of these things can completely fall away into the nature of yourself that can't be objectified. So that's what, and for over and over again now in these verses, this is what he's going to be looking at. Everything you think is important, every inquiry you do in the world becomes, in a sense, meaningless. Because the one who is the self And illumining those inquiries is free of the inquiry. So that's the whole idea. What do you care? What do you care about this for? Yourself is totally free of any inquiry that you do. So when you inquire into the nature of the self, which kind of leaves behind the universe, that self is whole and complete as it is, and not subject to any of these dwanas and triads. So they fall off, leaving the one that is to be known. That's his idea. So sit with yourself. That's what you want to know. You're coming to know yourself. So why are you looking at all of these objects? Bring your mind home to see who you are. And it's the mind resting in that self that you are. The nishta. Nishta means clarity, free from doubt. You know, so the mind that is clear about who you are, when the mind is clear about who you are, then these questions can, they're questions, but they're not relevant to your being. That's kind of a repetitive nature of Ramana's inquiry. So let's do the next one. Vidya katam bhati na cheta vidya. Vidya katam bhati na cheta vidya. Vidyam vinakim pravibhatya vidya. Vidyam vinakim pravibhatya vidya. Dvayam chakasyeti vicharya mula. Dvayam chakasyeti vicharya mula. Swarupa nishtha paramartha vidya. Swarupanishtha paramartha vidya. Here he says, vidya katam bhati na chet avidya. Vidyam vina kim pravibhati avidya. Dvayam chakasya iti vicharya mula. Vicharya, then as a compound, mula swarupa nishtha. Mula swarupa nishtha. Paramartha vidya. Now here he says, how can there be katam bhati vidya? How can there be knowledge vidya? How can I have knowledge of something? How can we have even the appearance of what we call knowledge? Nachet avidya. If there's no ignorance, right? It's a dvaita. I have knowledge of this, I'm ignorance of that. If there's no ignorance, how can there be knowledge? Right? How can I have that concept? Because everything is known, it's no longer a concept. So, vidya katam bhati na cheta vidya. How can there be knowledge if there's no such thing as ignorance? And then he says, vidyam vina, and without knowledge, how is ignorance known? Right? So he's saying the two are dependent upon each other. You know, there's nothing, if you have nothing to delineate the one from the other, then what is it? So without knowledge, how is there knowledge that there's no such thing as ignorance? Because you have nothing to discriminate, to differentiate your knowledge from. And without knowledge, how can there be such a thing as ignorance? Because you wouldn't know that you don't know. Right? I'll get into that in a minute. He says, dvayam chakasya iti vicharya. For one, having analyzed the dvayam chakasya, this question, this is the Ramana question, for whom is this dvaya? For whom is this duality between knowledge and ignorance? For whom is this dvaita, is this duality? Mula swarupa nishtha paramartha vidya. The paramartha vidya means that knowledge, that absolute knowledge, the knowledge that is beyond duality, the paramartha vidya, or the knowledge which is knowledge of the paramartha, that of absolute reality. So you could say absolute knowledge or the knowledge of the absolute paramartha vidya. That is mula swarupa nishtha. That is the abiding in one's own swarupa. The mula swarupa, the swarupa which is the adhishtana, the basis of all of this. And so here, you know, I remember when Swamiji used to do this Driksha Viveka in terms as a meditation, the differentiating the subject from the object, the seer from the seen. One really kind of important awakening or realization for me was, you know, when you start by you realize that this world is just objectified by your sense perception, including the body. So you make that subject-object differentiation. And then you realize that actually your sense organs also are known by the mind. The mind objectifies the sense organs and whether they work. There's a subject-object differentiation. Then you recognize that even the ahankara, the I thought, is something which is known. Just a thought. It's known. But then from that standpoint, then after that, Swamiji would go to this, and this is what was really meaningful to me. All of your knowledges are known also. He objectified what you know. I know this, I know this, you know, I know English, or I know Sanskrit, or I know whatever you know that you know. So your knowledge is objectified to you. As is your ignorance. You know what you know, you illumine what you know, and you illumine what you don't know. Like if I were to ask you, do you know Chinese? Most people would say, no, I don't know Chinese. How do you know that you don't know Chinese? I don't know. I'm certain that I don't know Chinese. So you're both, all of your knowledge, your accrual of knowledge, and all of your ignorance is also recognizable, because if somebody asks you if you know this or you know that, you can check it out. No, I don't know that. So what that means is that you illumine both your knowledge and your ignorance. The one who illumines both the knowledge and the ignorance is free of knowledge and ignorance. And that's that's the Paramartha Vidya. That's the Vidya, that's the knowledge, which is the capital K, which is consciousness. And so, in fact, I am, my being is the knowledge that I seek. In fact, I am the knowledge that backs all knowledge. Because knowledge, really, when you think about it in terms of this physical, in terms of the objectified creation, knowledge is, in a sense, a vritti, right? It's a jnana-vritti, a vritti, a thought modification that is true to the object. Nevertheless, knowledge is a vritti. It's a thought modification. That thought modification enjoys consciousness or enjoys knownness, right? It's illumined, means it enjoys consciousness, it enjoys knownness. The knownness is what makes it knowledge. This is known. This is known. This is known. See what I mean? The knownness that is enjoyed is because of the consciousness which illumines it. That's what allows it to be known. It doesn't have knownness in and of itself. The knownness is the very nature of consciousness. So when the vritti comes into consciousness, we, in our language, we say, vritti means thought modification. When the thought modification comes into consciousness, then we say, it is known, right? And then this thought comes into consciousness, it is known. Any perception that comes into consciousness, that is known. Another language we can say, it is lit up by consciousness. Any vritti that comes in, it is lit up by consciousness. Without the consciousness, it is not known. You see what I mean? If something doesn't come into consciousness, it is not known. That means that its knownness belongs to consciousness, not to the thing. So that's why the word known is a synonym, in a sense, to consciousness. And so when you're analyzing your experience into things that you know and the things that you don't know, you know, if I were to say, if I were to say a word like picture, you know that word, right? So this word, the word picture, is a known word, and it will evoke your kind of archetypal or generic image of a picture. You know, it's a known word. But if I were to say, like Swamiji's famous word, gagubugai, you know, then that word is just a jumble of sounds that doesn't evoke anything, right? It has a meaning, it's meaningless. But what is known is that this gagubugai sound doesn't mean anything to me. Or if I say, do you know Chinese, or have you ever been to, you know, to a certain remote city in Asia, or whatever I say, if you haven't been there, You know, you know that. You illumine that. And so, in fact, your ignorance is known. Right? Your ignorance of something is known. And then you can even say things like, you know, compared to compared to the amount that I know in reference to what is out there to be known is so minuscule that we can hardly count it. You know, that because the amount is a jiva, the amount that is not known is infinite. You know, compared to the little droplet of knowledge that I do have. But I can, that being true, I can still say, you can give me a list. Say we're going to be here for a million years. You can give me a list and say, do you know this? 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 It'd be vritti after vritti. And it's no, 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 I don't. No, 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 no. No, 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 no. Oh, yes. Mm-hmm. So now, the thing is that the vrittis, whether it's ignorance or knowledge, this is known, this is not known, both take place in knownness alone. The knownness is the constant. That is the very nature of consciousness. And we try to gain knowledge by accruing inert objects, in a sense. Things which themselves don't have anything to do with knowledge. Mm-hmm. I already am the knowledge that I seek. You know, the knowledge, the consciousness, the knownness, because of which all of these things are, that knownness is superimposed on all of these things, making me feel that, you know, now I know this and now I know this, where actually you're the non-dual, changeless knownness. You know, which all things that come into your consciousness enjoy. Does that make sense? And so here he says, you know, there's knowledge and there's ignorance. I know this, this, this. I don't know this, this, and this. Mm-hmm. Because there's knowledge, I do know things. Because I do know things, I can gain knowledge of things. Because that's possibility, because I have a mind. So because I can direct a vritti at any given thing, a thought modification at any given thing, it can become known. But in fact, all of these things, you know, on analyzing the situation, who is the knower of all of these things, the known and the unknown, of the knowledge and ignorance, if I look into who is the knower of both of these, for whom are both of these things, then what I end up with is kind of the nishtha in my own swarupa, which is the mula. Mula means cause, the mula swarupa, the very cause of the knownness of knowledge and the knownness of ignorance. And that is the paramartha vidya. That is the knowledge because of which, that's the knowledge, but that's the knownness which is superimposed on everything. And so, actually in the inquiry into Sat Chit Ananda, you know, when we're doing an inquiry into the truth of Sat Chit Ananda, I seek, you know, sometimes we'll say, you know, Sat is your being, your existence, you know. And if my being, my very existence, the Sat, the existence, the being that I am, is superimposed on this body, you know, is superimposed on the body, then I do everything I can to make this body live a day longer, you know, because my being is superimposed upon it. You know, but upon analysis, that Sat becomes free. Mm-hmm. It becomes free of the things that are actually objectified, which my being is something which is the conscious being because of which all of these things are objectified. That frees the Sat, the chit, which is what he's talking about here, is the consciousness which is this being. I seek to know. I seek to know. You know, I remember Swamiji so often saying, you know, like if you always want to know, like, this is, never mind. You always want to know. So say if you hear somebody having a conversation, he'll go on and on about this. Because if you hear somebody, you know, in the other room having a conversation, you know, you listen to hear what's going on. Or if you're walking by a mirror, You'll always look at it. We're always trying to gain and to accrue knowledge. We're always interested to know, you know? But in fact, that interested to know, to gain knowledge, to accrue knowledge, you know, to become Sarvajna in a way, you know, that whole thing is really the mind's just looking out to accrue the very being, the very consciousness that's been superimposed upon these things. It's pleasurable to know, this is known, this is known, this is known, this is known, because I am the known. That's the thing. I go after knowing so that this is known, this is known, there's a resolve in the known, this is known, this is known, this is known, this is known. Why is that so pleasurable? Because I am the known. I get to know, I get to feel complete because this is known, right? But actually, the knownness that I'm giving to this is the chit of my own swarupa. That knownness never comes and goes. It's what we call nacholanam when he's talking, it's nishta. And so knowledge is really my mind's own recognition of that, of having nishta, having clarity in my own swarupa, which is the very knowledge, the very knownness that I give to everything else. It's all right to recognize that everything in your experience is bathed in the knownness. But the problem comes is when you think you are different from the knownness that you've superimposed upon your experience. I am the knownness, which I am the known being, the conscious being, into which all experience comes. And that knownness is infinite. It's changeless. There's nothing you can't make it. You can't increase it. That's the thing. As much knowledge as you gain, you know, you can accrue knowledge, vrittis, the accrual of vrittis, you know, and be proud of all of this huge stack that you've accrued. You know, and vaults, you know, your vritti vault. You know. But the knownness is not accrued. You can't increase it, and you can't diminish it either. And that's in fact what you're seeking. So does this for about 10 more verses. I didn't look at this next verse very carefully. Let's stop with this one. You can have some satsang.
It won't increase knowingness.
No, we'll just sit in. We'll sit in our own knowingness for a little while. Purnamada, Purnamada, Purnat, Purnamadachate, Purnasya, Purnamadaya, Purnameva, Vashishyate, Om Shanti, 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 Hari Om Shri Gurubhyo Namaha.
Hare Om.
So this satisfaction you get when you know something new, or you know you feel like you can complete yourself by gaining more knowledge and you'll be a more fulfilled person, that isn't the case here?
No, not really. But the thing is, it's just like when you fulfill a desire. You know, anytime you fulfill a desire, the mind becomes calm,
mm-hmm.
because you've fulfilled something.
Mm-hmm.
And that gives you the sense that, you know, I'm whole and complete now, just because your mind has kind of moved out of the way.
Yeah.
That's all that's really happened.
Yeah.
It's the same when you gain some knowledge. It's very
rewarding
because now you know something, the mind relaxes in that moment. You know, it's all about Shanti, really. But what we want to be able to see, the discrimination, is to recognize that, I mean, we can spend our life working for different levels of quietude of mind. You know, but the mind by its very nature is going to be shifting and changing. That's what a mind does. You know, and it goes through all different types of variations. That's the nature of the mind. Sometimes it's very quiet, deeply quiet, and you feel so whole and complete and as though you are a spiritual person. And the mind's, you know, extremely quiet. But that's samsara. You know, it's samsara because you can't count on your mind to be in any one given way all the time. It's just not possible. The mind does all kinds of things. The freedom is not in these different states of mind. It's in the mind's recognition of that yourself that's always the same. It is always whole. It is always complete. It's what is stable in the whole situation. My presence is stable. You know, and my presence is a blessing. My presence actually blesses the mind, and the mind starts to recognize that and understand it, and it begins to depend on the mind for its being. Even if it didn't depend on the mind for its being, you know, if the mind didn't depend on the self for its being, that's still the reality. But the mind doesn't know that. When the mind knows that, it makes a huge difference. Then my presence, I am the very changeless, this Nachalanam, I am the changeless self of all of the different thoughts of my mind. And when you're doing the Viveka, we're doing it now in this verse, he's doing it in terms of knowledge about the things you know, all of the things you know and the things you don't know. You recognize that I am the knowledge, the knownness, which both the known and the unknown enjoy. I am that knownness, and it is constant and complete, and everything comes and rises and sets in it. You know, so I am the knowledge, I am the being. I'm the being that everything enjoys, I'm the knownness, the knowledge that everything enjoys. That's the ananda. Ananda is a tricky word, because when you say the sat chit ananda, we think of this word ananda as bliss. And it's a very confusing translation. Ananda really is ananta. Ananta means the limitlessness of my being. You know, the limitlessness, the absolute unencumbered nature of my being is what we mean by the ananda, swarupananda, the ananda of my own self. And so that unencumberedness of my being is not encumbered by the world. It doesn't do anything to it. But because there's nothing in the world that isn't my being. But when the mind is ignorant of it, of that fact, it hasn't done that discrimination, then what happens is that the mind gets itself into pain-producing. It produces pain for itself by its agitations and its depressions and its worries. You know, and all of these worries that the mind has has to do with trying to capture my being in samsara. You know, capture this object so that I can be happy. It's a total illusion. Like I run after this object, try to get this object, because if I could just have that, or that person, or whatever, then I would be happy. That's the belief. Because I haven't differentiated the wholeness of myself, you know, from all of these changing vrittis and changing situations. And so once I say, and of course you say it with commitment, because this is what we believe, I need this in order to be happy. This immediately, as soon as I have that conviction, then the world divides up and becomes stress. Stress is immediately produced. I need this to be happy. Why is it produced? Because I'm out there now.
Yeah.
You know? So I need that. I need that in order to actually be me. And so now what happens is the world divides up into those people that'll help me get that, and they're my friends and allies. You know, and the people who or situations that are negative to my getting that, those are my enemies. You know, and then I have to work my way toward that object. And then finally, I start realizing I'm actually going to get this thing. And then you start relaxing and feeling good about yourself and good about the world. And then you get it, and you have a moment of desirelessness because you've just fulfilled the desire. So look what happens to the mind. You fulfill the desire, and now your mind is the mind of jnani, in the sense that it doesn't want anything. It's what we call the alam buddhi. The alam buddhi is that conviction that it's enough. You know, it's called the alam. The word alam means enough. You get that alam buddhi if somebody's feeding you, especially in India. You say it's enough. It's enough. It's pouring food on you. It's enough. It's enough because you've eaten enough. You don't want any more. So here, when you fulfill a desire at that moment, your mind is quiet. It doesn't want anything because it's just fulfilled the desire. And so that mind, you know, then feels happy. It's not creating any kind of tension at all. You know? And that's all we know in samsara, is to fulfill desires or do things that we are familiar with, that we know can make us happy. Like, you know, simply fulfilling desires or going for a walk in nature. We have certain things that we can do that will, though we don't think like this, it does make us happy, but what it's really doing is creating a condition of shanti in the mind. Mm-hmm. You know, so we go on trying to create this shanti by making the world how we want it to be, by making our body how we want it to be, making our mind how we want to be, because we're dependent totally for any sense of well-being on these shanta vrittis. Right? But in fact, there's no moksha in that. That is samsara. That's everybody's story. The moksha is in the recognition of that paramarthika shanti, that shanti which is absolute, which is the very nature of myself. And the nature of that shanti, of my being, is whole and complete, and it is the limitlessness of it is the fullness on what we mean by the fullness in ananda. It's not a bliss experience. It's the me experience, the unencumbered me. And that unencumbered me is ananda, not upcoming and going bliss. And that ananda is also self effulgent. It is known. The ananda, the wholeness of my being is known because it's consciousness. Right? That is the chit. And that knownness is the knownness because of which the whole universe shines. That because of which everything is known. Without knownness, without the known, nothing could be known. Without consciousness, nothing could be known. So I'm that paramartha vidya. I'm that absolute knowledge, the knowledge because of which, the knowledge, the consciousness that's superimposed upon everything else. So this is known, this is known, this is known. But you know, if you got rid of the whole universe, what is left? The is known. Just me. The self-evident conscious being which is superimposed on everything.
And that's not
which
an
is the self of everything.
That's not an action.
If there's no really action, there's no real action involved, because we say superimposed and all of this type of thing. It's true from the standpoint of those of us in duality with the body, mind, sense organs, making all of these mistakes. But if you think about it with a clay pot, the pot is not superimposed on the clay. Is it? Not really. There's just clay there. This superimposition requires a mind to make a mistake and say, you know, if the pot breaks, the clay will be destroyed. You know, if I die, if this body dies, consciousness itself, its very being, will be destroyed, because its being depends on this body. That isn't true, but that's the samsara, you know. And so look at what it means to differentiate clay from pot. I mean, it's a kind of an odd thing to differentiate clay from pot when all that's really there is clay. Now, you have to differentiate the body, mind, sense organs, all the experiences within duality from the consciousness, which is what is actually here. See what I mean? Just like clay pot, what is actually here is clay. Not pot. It's clay that's here. There's no thing pot apart from clay. And there's no thing universe apart from me, apart from consciousness. But this Dehatma Buddhi, taking the self to be the body, is so thorough. You know, and all of the sense organs are looking outward, like in the Hatha Upanishad it says, you know, Bhagavan kind of made it a little, screwed up a little bit. He made all the sense organs going outward, and he didn't make one going inward. You know, there's nothing there to, I can be myself, but I can't see myself. I can't gain knowledge of myself. I can't, of my own self-experience, I have no means of knowledge to tell me what this self-experience is from the standpoint of the body and the mind and the sense organs. And the self, just the conscious being, the me, the conscious being that you are, you know, doesn't have a voice. I just am. There's no, I am not I that am not saying I am.
No.
I'm not, can't say to you, I'm infinite, I'm consciousness, I'm changeless. Notice me, please. Don't worry about all of this.
Don't worry about
it. You need a shastra. You need the Upanishads. You need that teaching methodology that acts like a mirror and comes in and, you know, shows you, makes you see. It differentiates the self-shining conscious being that you are from the changing experiences that have no separate being of their own. You know, like you can't separate any of your experience and kind of separate it. Here's the consciousness here, or sat existence here, and let me take this experience and drop it outside somewhere, away from that. Well, away from there is non-existence. See what I mean? You can't separate anything from being itself. Being is the clay. And that being is self-evident, self-shining. Another thing important here that's so critical to understand and kind of sitting with yourself, you are consciousness. You're not consciousness of something. You are self-evident consciousness that illumines, yet that is self-luminous, but you're not lighting anything up. Everything is lit up, but you're not doing that. You know, so there's no knowership here. It's just that the sense organs and the mind can be knowers because of consciousness. But consciousness itself, you're not knowing anything. You're just the light because of which everything is known. And you, the consciousness knownness, is the self of everything. And so that's everything is known because that's the swarup, that's the nature of the whole universe. The knownness really in the end belongs only to consciousness.
Well, why do I feel like that's not a relief enough?
Well, it's because the mind is creating pain for you. That's why. like you can say you've cut your arm or something, your arm is creating a lot of pain, and then you'll say, you know, get me the doctor, what Brahman, you know. You have to take care of these issues that are distracting you.
But there also seems to be a kind of a disbelief in what you just said. I mean, I see the truth of it, but the mind can disbelieve that. It doesn't seem...
Yeah, but you can say disbelief, but actually, you know what? Knowledge, self-knowledge and vairagya go together. They walk hand in hand. And so that's what kind of the bugaboo is, because it takes a lot of maturing that does not happen overnight for the mind to give up its commitments to samsara. I want this, things should be like this, you know. It's just there's a web of desires, and there's a web of desires. We don't call everything desires, but that's what it is. I need this. I need this to be happy. You can say, I need things to be like this to be happy. I need you to be like this to be happy. Mm-hmm. I need the world to be like this to be happy.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and that's the problem. That means you, the jiva, is totally enmeshed in sati into samsara, into this kind of subject-object relationship where the objects have to be in a particular way so that you can relax and be happy. That all has to sort itself out, you know. And we all come to this knowledge with different sets of, you know, needs and commitments. You know, commitments means, you know, I have to have this and I have to have that, and it has to be this way in order for me to feel whole and complete. And one by one, in the light of our knowledge, we drop those off because they're actually cause tremendous suffering. Every one of them.
Well, they make separation all the time.
They make separation, and see, if you say, I have to have this to be happy, I want this so that I can be happy, then you're obviously not happy because you don't have it yet. Okay? But the samsara is this, and this is what creates the mumukshu. People go through cycles of this from beginningless time, really. If we say that the jiva, the births are beginningless, I want this so that I can be happy. This stands for whatever. Whatever we all have our list. I want this so that I can be happy. Then what happens is you struggle and struggle, and sometimes you're very disappointed. But then so you get it. Okay, now you have it. Now the question is, are you happy? But no. you'll be happy maybe for a few moments. And then the mind will say, come up almost immediately with the next thing. Now, yes, that's good, I've got that. Now if I can only have that too.
Mm-hmm.
I need this too, and then I'll be happy. Mm-hmm. Or what can even come before that is you get it, the thing, and then immediately comes a worried thought about how you can lose it. The mind doesn't just stop. You don't fulfill the desire and say, okay, all is well with me. It lasts for the most minuscule period of time. And that's disappointing. It's shocking. The thing is, once that becomes shocking, you become a mumukshu, I think. For a while, it's not shocking. This happens for beginningless time. It's not really shocking because your mind is so quickly on to the next thing that you don't really notice the horror of the whole thing. You know, you just immediately go to the next thing that you need to do in order to protect what you have or gain that next little nuanced thing that you hadn't thought of that now you need. Just keep going, going, going. But at some point your mind stops. And you just realize that pattern, you know, and that it doesn't work at all. And then you start looking, you have to start inquiring.
Oh, I was hearing you say, at some point your mind stops.
To analyze the situation.
Right, it's more like you're starting to see what your mind is doing.
Mm-hmm.
And in that way, there's a little bit of space, but your mind still does.
It still does, but you start to notice.
Yeah, that's
you notice the pattern, and you notice also that it doesn't work. Mm. That the pursuit doesn't work. That in fact, that it does not. That it doesn't give anything lasting happiness. And then upon more analysis, you actually realize the impossibility of it being able to do that. Because the whole world of experience, subject-object experience, is continually changing. You can't stop. You can't take a camera, you know, like a still shot of something to be able to capture. It's simply not possible. So this type of inquiry, you know, becomes natural to the mind, and then you start to seek, well, what is the answer? Is there any way for me to fulfill myself? Is there any way to get to the other shore where I can just rest, where I can say all is well with me? Mm-hmm. Because if I'm trying to get that all is well with me, I'm free, I'm whole, complete, you know, I've done all that needs to be done, there's no possibility of my getting to a state like that within samsara, within duality. It's absolutely impossible because there's nothing in duality that's not changing, you know? And so the moment will pass you by. You'll have a moment, but that's what it is, a moment. And that's what we all experience. So when you start analyzing your experiences, you start to realize that it's impossible to get that. You can get that lineup where I desire something, you know, I'd have a desire for something, and the something that I desire is there in the way that I desire it, you know. So that requires a lot right there. I want it. And the thing that I want is there, you know, in my grasp. For that moment. Now this requires that thing has to remain in the way that it is that I want it, and I have to keep wanting it. Mm-hmm. We never find that, you know? That's why we have all these garage sales and everything. And divorces.
Garage sales.
Yeah, everybody goes into the garage sale. But I mean, it's just, you can talk about all of this for forever, but it's just analysis of your experience. Mm-hmm. You know, just, oh, there really is only one thing that is stable, unfortunately, that's yourself.
Well, there's something about letting go of this duality. I mean, you can see the wholeness of yourself, but at the same time, you have to let go. There's a process of...
There is a process of letting go, and it's going to be very hard, some of the biggies. It's like the monkey with a hand in the jar full of nuts. When the monkey's grabbing onto the nuts, it can't get its hand out of the jar. Right? And that's why they use that in India on the porches. You know, they have these big pottery jars with little tiny bowls, and it's all full of nuts, and the monkey puts its hand in. And then, of course, it can't get its hand out if it's holding on to the nuts. And actually, it cannot do it. That's why they make those jars like that. And so then when the owner of the house comes out with its stick, you would think that the monkey would let go and run. You know?
So what does he do? I've never seen
it. It gets beaten. It'll get beaten and beaten and beaten.
And it won't let go.
And it will not let go of those nuts until finally it lets go and scampers off. That's how we are. That's what we do.
Wow.
You know? We know that. I mean, maybe the monkey knows. I mean, I imagine the monkey knows in its own little way. It's saying, you know, if it's kind of a mamuksu monkey, it's saying, mamuksu monkey is saying, I know I have to let, I should let go. I can't let go.
Not yet.
This isn't fair. Yeah. It isn't fair that I should even be in this situation. Bhagavan is being really, really unkind to me, and these people are not fair, and they're really awful. You know, and I'm not letting go.
They're not just either.
They're not just. And so we develop a whole world around this thing. But in the end, you have to let go and let it be. and you feel, honestly, because I've been through all of this, as we all have, it is such a relief. I mean, you can't believe. I mean, I have stories. They're too personal to tell. Too embarrassing. But, you know, where you just hang on to something until you're half dead. It takes that long to let these things go. And when you let it go, you're free. Because yourself is free all along. Mm. You know, but you can concoct such a story around the thing. And, you know, what is just, unjust, and, you know,
how it should be.
How it should be and how people really should be and how could this have happened and these, you know. And you're just hanging on for dear life in misery, and at some point you let go. And then in my own experience, what I found is once you've had a couple of those, then, and you realize the incredible relief in letting go, it becomes easier to let go and easier to recognize. You know, that's the thing. You don't always recognize. And your mind is so committed to the samsara in one form or another that you don't really think of it. But after some time, you do think of it, and you know how to manage that, and you know that the rewards are great.
Because that's a maturing process. You can't command the mind. Okay.
You can develop your ability to think things through instead of when you're getting stuck and miserable. You know, in your stuckness, you can learn how to step back and do some vichara to really think it through.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's what all this teaching is, that you see things at the time of teaching and then you go out into the world and all of the old habits come back, you know. But there comes a time when those habits come back, but they're coming back into your knowledge and understanding. And you start dealing with them differently. You know, the mind is setting up some new tracks because of your knowledge, you know. Mind is complex with all of the unconscious things going on and, you know.
And there's also a great deal of prarabdha karma that's playing into the mind, right? Also into the state of where the mind is.
You know, that's true. The prarabdha karma. The thing is, the prarabdha, initially anyway, on a more physical level, the prarabdha are the situations that the universe puts you in. Now, so that's kind of just the physical story of your life. And in fact, for Ajnani, really, part of the tremendous freedom is just, this is your life. You don't really have to work for it. Here it is. You know, and the situations that unfold for you are your prarabdha. Now, but, so there's that. Just the physical unfoldment of your life from birth to death. In that unfoldment, there's this little catch. And that is that the prarabdha, the fulfillment of the prarabdha gives 50% punya, 50% papa. Means 50% of the situations are enjoyable and easy. Neutral, easy, fine. 50% are hard. Hard, harder, hardest. You know? And so those can, like sometimes you say, that it's working me. Those situations work my mind. You know, I have to learn how to, let's say if I'm gaining knowledge, I have to bring my knowledge to those kind of situations, you know, because they're meant to cause pain. But those situations are challenging. And for somebody who has knowledge, a moksha, somebody gaining knowledge, it's those situations that are kind of my sadhana. The easy situations are fine. I can just skate through that and enjoy Ishwara and it's all wonderful. But the difficult situations are the ones that bring about the maturity. You know, if I look at those situations as sadhana and what's primary to me is, for mumukshu, what's primary to you is knowledge, really. And then these difficult situations, it's not I'm not striking out at the difficult situation as much as I'm trying to bring the difficult situation into my knowledge, rather than just being a jiva chasing after the situation.
And then how did inner child work relate to this karmic pattern that's playing?
The inner child work, I would say, when a situation is really grabbing you on, you know, with a lot of affect or hurt, there's probably a little one inside.
Oh.
Because otherwise it's much easier for us just to be objective and deal with the situation.
Uh-huh.
But often there's a lot being triggered inside. When something's triggered inside, like there's a lot of feeling or hurt or all of these things that are usually quite a bit bigger than the situation, that's when we have to go do some inner work and see, you know, what's going on in there. Otherwise, we can just bring our knowledge to it and you can let it go and it's fine.
Yeah.
But so much of the time, something deeper gets triggered, and that's where this inner child work comes in.
I see. Yeah.
That's why it's really important to know all of that. If you just think that there's just your conscious mind and this, then nobody's taking care of kind of a deeper level of the psyche that has a lot of the wounded level. We all have, we're all wounded. You know, you can't grow up and not have problems. So I don't think it's possible, especially in this era, if ever. So those have to be tended and dealt with.
So it's like the becoming like an artist and transforming lead into gold, right, into your own psyche.
It is, in a sense. It all takes place through love, really. Love is the elixir of everything. You know, but the problem with us, with our concept of love, is you often leave yourself out. So that you can have a tremendous value for being patient and caring for others. If we, you know, are dharmis, who those are our highest values, and you do your best, and then if you slip, you try again. That's just what we do. But we don't do that same. We don't give ourselves, our own psyche, that same love and care and wanting to help. But once you can do it all the way around, then it's really your psyche starts to change.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, the unconscious starts to change. That's really what it needs. It needs love. You know, I said it needs to be liked. It needs to be loved. It needs to be respected, just as everybody does.
You know? The self-love thing, I think, is so good.
Mm-hmm. And if you have that toward what's going on inside of you, with the weaknesses and things that you do that you don't like, this or that, if you have that type of respect and love and like, then you give the same space to others.
Yeah.
The space you give to yourself, the space that you really give to yourself is the space that you really give to others.
Is that because we
that's the truth of it.
Why is that hard? Is it because we haven't learned the technique, or it wasn't taught, or is there some other reason?
It's funny, isn't it? It seems like such an obvious thing, but
yeah.
It seems to be quite a huge oversight.
Duh.
It does, really. It's an obvious thing. But
yeah.
The time.
Once it's taught, it's obvious. What'd you say?
Well, it's probably a time thing, too.
What do you mean?
Well, it's like we need to give ourselves space, and we have to give ourselves time, and we're not very patient in that way.
Yeah, exactly. You know, that's why Swamiji uses that example of, you know, receiving, you give somebody a rose, beautiful little rosebud. Especially, you can imagine giving it to a child, it's a beautiful little rosebud. The child, you know, once that bud opens and so starts pulling away at it, you know, instead of letting it do its natural blossoming. Maybe we try to pull ourselves open instead of, you know, letting that maturing process take place and enjoying that maturing process also. Enjoying your own ability to handle situations that a year ago you couldn't handle, that type of thing.
There's a beautiful saying, the earth that makes you fall also helps you to get up again.
The earth, what is it?
The earth that makes you fall.
Yeah.
It's also, that same earth also helps you to get up again.
Yeah, yeah. With that, that's beautiful.
I don't know where it comes from, but it puts it kind of energetically into a balance. Mm-hmm. That's kind of what I feel when I think about that.
Yeah. That's beautiful. I haven't heard that. I like that.
But it is a strange oversight. But now we don't.
I think it's gotten confused, like with ideas of being humble and narcissism. There's funny ideas like you should love others, not yourself. You should give to others, not, you know, in the act of giving to others. You shouldn't give to yourself. You should love others, not yourself. If you love yourself, you're narcissistic. So these are simple, just lack of really understanding what those words mean. But I think they condition us. Mm-hmm. You know,
isn't it kind of simplified religious type of beliefs? I mean, I was raised with that kind of, like Catholic, when a mother is in labor and the doctor has to choose between the child and the mother, the Catholics were taught to choose the child so the mother would die. Mm-hmm. Which is crazy because there's 10 children without a mother, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, it's... But it was very strong, this, like, you're nothing. You know, you gotta take everybody else.
Yeah. And also the concept of sin.
Just the self-hatred.
Yeah, self-hatred.
Self-hatred. Mm-hmm.
But I think those things are not exactly on point, but they lead to this natural way of being, of not taking yourself into consideration when you're caring.
Yeah.
The caring goes only outward. It doesn't go inward. Mm-hmm. But it's only when it really goes all the way in all directions that it blesses people. Because you can't hate yourself and love others. You know, because it's a hated person that's trying to do the loving. You know, this doesn't work. So, and you know, self-loathing and this self-loathing is a common problem, too, in this era. Self-loathing, self-hatred.
Oh, they say that?
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. Psychologically, it's a common problem of our era.
Mm.
And so that one who feels that self-loathing or self-hatred, you know, has to have another part of yourself come in and say, I love you.
Yeah.
I don't hate you, I love you.
So we are psychologically and to some extent swimming in that then.
To some extent, yeah. Kohut talks about that.
Who?
Heinz Kohut, who's self-psychology.
Yeah.
Yeah, he called it kind of the ailment of our time.
Kohut?
Kohut, K-O-H-U-T, and self-psychology. He's a really good psychologist. Has nailed a few things. He's also the one that said, the body requires oxygen to survive. You know, empathy is the oxygen of the soul.
Mm-hmm.
Mirroring, positive mirroring is the oxygen for the soul. All the way through. for humans, for a person's life, if there's no they require positive mirroring in order to want to survive, yeah. To flourish, yeah. Just like the body requires oxygen. You know, I think there's a lot of truth in that. I mean, we need to feel seen.
Yeah. Well, Ramana didn't seem to be plagued by this stuff, or he just skipped over. Or...
Yeah, that's a good observation. That's kind of the impression I have too, you know, when I hear. Because he came into this when he was 16.
Yeah.
You know, I think that this man had a different karma or birth because he did. I mean, it seems
he came
like
in maybe kind of like an Uttama Adhikari.
What does that mean?
Means he took this birth with a very high degree of maturity.
Yeah, yeah.
And there's another thing that really the source of Ananda, or the source of bliss for the mind, not that the self is bliss, but the mind, when it's very quiet and focused on the self, it itself experiences what we call bliss. The self is much more, it's indescribable in terms of wholeness or fullness or bliss. It is its own thing, it's its own fullness. But when the mind is focused or absorbed into the self, all of the love that you could ever want, you know, is completed in that. That's why that's why people meditate, actually. Mm-hmm. You know, or like to just abide with yourself, because that is the source of wholeness. And Ramana was able to do that. And notice that he didn't come out very often.
Yeah.
So we didn't know what was going on out here, just stayed in there. I see an ants all over.
There's a lot of people, you know, a certain amount of people that have these so-called awakening experiences, and then they come out of it, and then they have to do these years of homework. You know.
Well, that's true. They can get very confused.
And he never had to do that. He just stayed there.
He stayed there, but the thing to understand is he stayed there practicing just samadhi.
Yeah.
Until some pundits came and imposed themselves on him and taught him. You're going to do tips?
Okay.
And taught him the Upanishads. You know, and then he didn't have to stay in or out. It was all the same thing.
That's very interesting.
But what was the point for the pundits to teach him about the Upanishads, really? I mean,
well, because I'm just making this up because I don't know the real story, other than what I'm saying, but there's no reason to be sitting in samadhi all the time.
Mm-hmm.
What's the difference? If your eyes are open or your eyes are closed, I'm just the whole. And when they went through, as the story goes, when they just went through these Upanishads, as they said, he knew exactly. But whatever veil of ignorance that was there that kept him being one thing that had to meditate on another, you know, that totally disappeared.
I see, that was actually, you mean an evolutionary shift?
Not evolutionary, just a shift in your understanding.
Yeah. Well, yeah, that's what I mean.
Yeah. It's a big shift, though. Because in the one, the ego is still with the... There's the jiva meditating on the self, resolving into the self. And the other, there's the self. You know, so that there's quite a shift there.
So
you recognize that with your eyes open, your mind thinking, whatever experiences that you're having, nothing's happening to you. You don't require to blot out the universe.
Because it seems like he needed to do that, or he would have been in trouble.
I don't know that.
But I mean, it appears that way. I'm not.
No, well, I mean, if you can say that. But it just, whatever condition he was, or whatever great saintliness he had also, there was a shift there, and that shift is just a final dissolution of the ahankara.
Well, it's like you said, it didn't make any difference whether he had his eyes closed or open.
That's right.
So...
Because nothing happens.
Right, and he knew that to a degree, I'm sure, but somehow being being told the Upanishads, like, wow, this exists out there.
Yeah, you know, when told, he saw. That's
yeah,
what they said.
Yeah.
Well, he maybe already saw before. It was just a little shapeshift there.
That's what I mean, yeah. Because there's nothing in the way to have seen that. That's how they talk about it.
Yeah.
You should all read books on Ramana.
But, you know, other Vedanta teachers have said that Ramana really wasn't a teacher. He really just shared his experience in a way. I mean, he shared something very true, of course, but he skipped over a lot of things.
Yeah, he did. But he had his own way of trying to direct his students but that's right. He didn't deal very much with Ishwara. He was just trying to direct his students to the recognition. So, let's call it a night. Okay.